My clients were inclined to blame me for this, and we all agreed that it would be best if I returned to Mexico. 64. A truck came by heading for Mexico City, and I arranged with the driver for a ride. Brimming over with my recent experience, I started to tell it to the truck driver. The latter quickly silenced me by suggesting that I had been smoking marijuana. After this rebuff, I began to realize for the first time something of the difficulty and the danger of telling of my experience. On arriving home, however, I did relate it to my wife and my two elder sons. Salvador's verbal account of his experience was carefully recorded in great detail so that we could make full use of it in our investigation which was to follow. Rune, remark the book on this case from the author himself, of I in PDF format. http://galactic.to/rune/smoker/salvador_villanueva-medina_ufa-contact1952.pdf Chapter 10. Our trip to Valls. For to understand our Valls trip, it is essential briefly to introduce a Mexico City friend of ours whom we shall call Bilgi. He is a fabulous character, a North American who came to Mexico 6 or 7 years ago on a vacation and just never went back to the States. He fell in love with Mexico, and nobody could be with him for any length of time without doing the same thing. He became a professor of English in one of the schools, but is so versatile he could profess most anything on short notice. Bilgi has something that most people in the States have lost: enthusiasm. Endless enthusiasm for what? For life and all the interesting things it holds. For example, people, kids, painting, teaching, poetry, pottery, ants, cats, and flying saucers. This last enthusiasm is of rather recent origin, and you can probably blame us for it. Anyway, we could not see a Mexican exploration trip on saucers without our good friend Bilgi, and he was delighted at the prospect. Everything was set for 5 a.m. January 12, 1955. It was a damp and dark morning as we quietly rolled our car out onto the street so as not to disturb our apartment neighbors. Shortly afterwards, Senor GB arrived with his son, who is an expert photographer, loaded down with shovels, camping equipment, and photographic apparatus. Soon the Mexican chauffeur, Salvador Villanueva Medina, appeared. He was of course the kingpin in this adventure. But where was Bilgi? We waited and waited and wondered whether to drive to his house and get him, or whether we would thus miss him on the way. Finally, out of the darkness came Bilgi with his Van Dyke beard framed by an amazing new 10-decimeter white sombrero. He murmured something about cats causing the delay. Bryant started the motor and we were on our way to Valls, about 300 miles distant, to investigate Salvador's saucer contact. On the way there was time for a little leisurely conversation, and Helen began to chide Bilgi about his cats. She finally wormed out of him that recently he had borrowed a very expensive male Persian cat from a certain senora as a companion for his female cat. That morning, as he was hurrying to get ready to meet us, he found the prize cat was missing, so poor Bilgi was torn between finding the expensive cat and getting started. In desperation he went around the dark neighborhood calling, "Kitty, Kitty." No luck. Perhaps the cat only understood Spanish. He returned home, and there he discovered the blank thing asleep on his roof. Senor GB did some translating into Spanish, and everybody enjoyed the humor of the situation. "Bilgi," inquired Helen, "do you mean to insinuate you are going in for feline procreation at this time of life? If you succeed, what in the world are you going to do with the baby kittens?"
"I'll cross my kittens when I come to them," snorted Bilgi. That reply was not translated into Spanish. Who could do it? Salvador was feeling more at home with us all the while, and this is just what we wanted to happen. In many saucer experiences, the kind of proof we all would like is difficult to find, so that the credibility of the sorcerer is of paramount importance. As we neared the town of Valls, Salvador became very alert and watched the east side of the road continually. We told him we would stop the car any time he wished, for after all the trail was 17 months old. We came to Valls, an attractive Mexican town of about 14,000 population, and drove on through the town continuing northward at a very slow speed. Salvador's tension increased as we passed kilometer post 483, then post 484. Suddenly he shouted and jumped from the car. He was very excited and cried, "This is it! This is the place!" He rushed around looking for a little hill or mound and found it, climbed upon it and pointing his finger he exclaimed, over there is where the saucer took off. I saw it from here." We did everything we could to try to discourage Salvador from being so positive about this being the place. We persuaded him to get back into the car and we drove northward many miles farther, suggesting he continue to watch the road. He kept saying, "No, no." We returned to the original spot and got out of the car and made a preliminary survey of the region. We had with us the transcripts of his previously written description of the entire locale in detail, and these checked well with all the details in front of us. For instance, the written account told exactly the nature of the soil under the car and that the location was near a small stone quarry, etc. We carefully checked point after point and found them to agree. As it was beginning to get dark, we decided to return to Val's for the night. The next day and night we spent at the saucer site. We parked our car exactly where Salvador said the broken-down Buick was parked 17 months previously. We discussed again the conversations he had had with the spaceman and walked over the ground time after time to where the saucer had landed, which was about 1.5 kilometers off the highway. We took samples of the soil and vegetation. Bilge mapped the entire area. We then asked Salvador not how big the saucer was, for we had his written statement that it was about 10 meters in diameter, but how big it looked to him when he saw it rise and fly away when he was standing by the Buick. Bilge had Salvador extend his arms and spread his fingers to show the exact apparent size as well as the direction of the saucer, and then took a compass reading of this direction. He then constructed a paper model of the saucer representing the apparent size as viewed from the road, and by a series of triangulations came out at practically the same spot that Salvador had previously designated as being the landing spot of the saucer. One additional bit of information about this contact developed during our repeated reenactments of the dirt tales. As we were walking from the parked car across the fields toward the spot where the saucer landed, Salvador was reminded of a detail he had omitted in the written transcript. It was this: back in August of 1953, the fields were muddy off the highway in the direction where the saucer landed. As Salvador followed the spaceman back to the ship, he was having difficulty wading through the mud. He noted that the spaceman, however, seemed to be walking above the mud. There was no mud on them when they arrived at the saucer, but his own shoes were covered with mud. As night fell, we chose a secluded spot several kilometers off the highway, not too far from the spot where the saucer landed, and pitched our camp. Everyone was dog-tired and hungry. We cooked our meal and warmed some coffee with the help of a campfire and an alcohol stove. We decided to take turns sleeping on the ground and in the car, with two of us always on sentry duty. We had chosen this spot mostly for its apparent seclusion. We had often wondered, while speeding along Mexican lugways, what it was like off the road, back in the Mexican hills which seemed so desolate and deserted when viewed from the highway. A great surprise was in store for us. Was our camp hidden and isolated? Heavens no, it turned out to be more like Grand Central Station. Every hour first came a farmer who chatted with us, drank some of our coffee, and kindly loaned us two of his dogs for protection. Next came a native with a can of fresh water. While we were conversing with him, our newly acquired canine protectors proceeded to drink our water. Later on came men on horseback, then hunters on foot carrying lights and guns, followed by some gentry mounted on burros. Shortly after midnight, some mothers came and presented us with gourds which we cooked in our campfire. We had not planned on any of this, but it seems it was party night at Camp Saucer in the desolate country off the Laredo Road. Many visitors came to pay their respects, and we supposed to satisfy their curiosity. We did not tell them our mission and they did not ask. Everyone was happy but exhausted from lack of sleep. About 2 a.m. it had become cold, cloudy and dark as pitch, and things had quieted down somewhat. Bryant and I were on watch, poking up the fire in an attempt to keep warm. Suddenly over the tops of the trees to the north appeared a moving white light in the sky. Bryant watched it intently and then ran and climbed a rickety wooden fence to the rear of us to get a better view. "Get the binoculars quickly," he called excitedly. I too had seen the light and knew what he must be thinking. My heart pounded as I ran to the car and tripped over the others who were trying to sleep. "What's up?" they demanded. "Saucers," I yelled. Like a flash they were up running wildly for the fence. By the time I returned with the binoculars, they were all perched on top of the fence like crows. So I made like a crow also. The fence was a tall rickety affair tied together with what appeared to be plant fibers. It was swaying back and forth in the cold night breeze, and we were all hanging on for dear life. We seemed to think that being a few feet off the ground would give us a much better view of the heavens. The moving light was still there, and as we strained our eyes it was soon joined by another moving light. "Look at that," came shouts in both English and Spanish. Excitement was at fever pitch. Bryant grabbed the glasses from me. There was a pause as Bryant focused them on the flying lights. I thought the fence would crash any minute. The suspense was unbearable. Then Bryant began to laugh. 70 fireflies, said he in utter disgust. Fireflies, nothing but fireflies. Thus ended our trip to Val's in the quest of saucer science. We might mention the gigabytes, but on second thought the least said about them the better. Salvador was terribly disappointed that the fireflies did not turn out to be his spacer friends returning again. We intended taking him directly to his home upon our arrival in Mexico City, but he insisted on going to church before going home to his family. So as we reached the outskirts of Mexico City we let him off at the Shrine of Guadalupe. The soil and vegetation samples from the saucer site were tested by a Geiger counter but showed no evidence of radiation. This probably meant little after 17 months. And we were told later that a different type of radiation test is needed, such as has been developed in England. While the type of proof usually demanded by the public was lacking, we felt very good about the trip. After our experience with Salvador, we at least in our own minds were convinced that the Mexican chauffeur had told the truth. We have been asked outright if we feel he could have dreamed the whole thing. Our answer is a definite no, for many reasons which would take too long to discuss. We had set out to convince ourselves, one way or another, and this we had succeeded in doing. Once again may we emphasize the point that we have found no easy high road to saucer knowledge. It is an individual effort all the way. The story with many photographs blossomed out in St. Norgibi's newspaper. This story also has a sequel to it which came about when George Adamski came to Mexico. The sequel convinced us even more, and we shall refer to it later. Chapter 11. Adamski comes to Mexico. We were having fun in this fabulous land of Mexico. We liked Mexico and the Mexican people and the many friends we had made. We landed on Mexican television, we landed in the movies, we appeared in the newspapers. We were elected charter members of a newly formed Mexican Society of Interplanetary Investigation and were members of a newly formed English-speaking saucer club. Despite all this, we took trips and explored the beautiful country at every opportunity. "How do you do it?" asked our friends. "Do what?" we inquired. "Get around and know everybody and do everything in a foreign country. You, our friends, do it all for us," we answered. That was true, provided we included the help we received from all the people we met who were interested in saucers. As to our Mexican movie career, it might be called lurid and brief. It had nothing to do with our saucer interest. We appeared with others as typical gringo tourists in a play entitled Ensayo de un Crimen, Rehearsal for a Crime, directed by the distinguished Spanish movie director, Luis Buñuel. Before leaving Mexico we had a chance to see a preview, And what took us 3 days of hard work and 29 repeats in the studio took about 120 seconds on the screen. Our appearance at times in the newspapers was the direct result of our saucer activities. This also applied to television. We were invited to appear on a television program called Mesa de Celebridades, the Table of the Celebrities, which originated from the beautiful roof de Den restaurant atop the Continental Hotel in downtown Mexico City. It was something like the programs in the States in which club guests are informally interviewed, and televised right at their tables. The handling of this question and answer program in both English and Spanish using an interpreter was beautifully arranged. I was asked some technical questions on saucers and Helen was given more general questions. The moderator asked Helen, "You who know George Adamski personally as you do, and Dr. Williamson, one of the witnesses present at the contact with the Venusian Don, do you feel that the possibility exists that they might have, in all good faith, set down as factual experience what might well have been a mirage or hallucination?" Helen replied very seriously, "Let us assume that it was an hallucination. If so, six people other than Mr. Adamski had the same hallucination. The hallucination made very deep impressions of his footprints on the sand. And the hallucination borrowed a photographic plate from Mr. Adamski, which the hallucination later returned. I would say that it must have been a very intelligent hallucination." This reply caused considerable amusement and favorable comment not only from those in the studio but from outside listeners to the program. Amidst all these busy activities, we received a letter from George Adamski saying that he would come to Mexico for a vacation and rest on March 21, 1955. By that time his and Leslie's book Flying Saucers Have Landed had been published in Spanish, and he also wished to confer with his publisher. Both a Mexican and an English-speaking contingent of admirers drove to the airport to meet him. A little ceremony of greeting had been planned. But as luck would have it, his plane came in a half hour early due to a tailwind and we found him wandering around the enormous air terminal like a lost ghost. From then on there occurred a series of bizarre events that proved the old adage of travelers anything can happen in Mexico. Some of these happenings so nearly resembled a fantastic light opera plot that even while they were occurring they seemed, to us, more like fiction than reality. As we all seemed to be playing parts in this amazing drama, we had to pinch ourselves at times to make sure we were really awake. Well, let us at least give you a few glimpses. First of all, let us say that there was mighty little vacation and practically no rest ahead for Mr. Adamski. The demands on his time by both individuals and groups interested in the sources were overwhelming. Private invitations poured in, and the English-speaking group planned a nice series of events for him with no other motive in mind but to give those interested in saucers a chance to meet him and to hear of his experiences. They just naturally thought in terms of procedures considered normal in the States. They enthusiastically planned a press conference. An ILL-fated press conference. As our apartment was not too far from downtown Mexico, we offered it to the committee for the occasion of the press conference. It turned out to be quite an affair in more ways than one. The hour arrived and the place was literally jammed with committee members, press representatives, photographers and some distinguished visitors. There was an air of excitement and anticipation. In came Mr. Adamski. Photo bulbs popped and friendly introductions followed. There was no lack of voluntary interpreters as questions rained down on this saucer from the States. Most of them were the normal questions we were quite familiar with. A few of the questioners seemed rather skeptical. It was a memorable picture. Mr. Adamski, a kindly and friendly man, a long way from home, sitting in our apartment in Mexico in the midst of the scribes. We almost added Pharisees because we found out later that there were present some who, without any just reason whatsoever, would later try to injure this man who had come to them with nothing but friendship in his heart. The next few days we watched the papers, and to the great surprise of the group the publicity, with a few bright exceptions, ranged from none at all to thinly veiled insinuations. The group was quite puzzled, but finally learned that a press conference is the wrong way to introduce anyone on an educational basis, as they had intended to do. South of the border, it seems that a press conference is a direct invitation to paid publicity, and without paid publicity one is apartment to achieve, shall we say, unpaid publicity. This was Act 1, Scene 1, of the amazing drama we were all to play a part in very soon. Pays us did and the wrong son. Act 1, Scene 2, soon followed. One day we were in our apartment and went on to our balcony to enjoy the gorgeous sunshine, one of Mexico's greatest assets. The sleeping lady and her boyfriend Popo, snow-capped volcanoes, were clearly visible in the distance, an inspiring sight. Our doorbell rang. We opened the door and there stood a group of Mexican gentlemen of exceptionally distinguished and dignified mien. A veritable aura of formal dignity and correct politeness swept into the room as they entered. It was indescribable. A group of VIPs, if ever there was such. Fortunately, one of them spoke English. They were delegates from a group of distinguished Mexican doctors and physicians. Their mission? To prevail upon our good old spices to try to prevail upon Mr. Adamski to speak before their group. We immediately telephoned Mr. Adamski at his hotel, and he agreed to speak. A time and place was arranged. They were overwhelmed with his generosity and graciousness and with our assistance. The eminent gentlemen bowed themselves out of our apartment. The atmosphere of the room almost seemed to go flat as they took their aura of eminence with them. They moved toward the elevator. Helen rushed out to help them and to push the elevator button. The cage soon arrived, and the door opened. Then it happened. 75. One of the dignified seniors bowed to the others and said, "Pays us did, pays us did. That is, you pass first, or you first, or after you." By the time I had reached the scene, from the less polite but more pragmatic North American viewpoint, it had become a riot. By then it seemed that all of the VIPs had reached the 11th inning of Pays Us Did. What they did not know, bless them all, was that they were about to lose the series because some players on another floor were wildly ringing for the elevator. Helen, almost in hysterics from ill-suppressed North American laughter at this unaccustomed little drama, was doing her best to shoo them into the elevator. Finally, like a miracle, the dam broke, and they all moved forward practically in a body, a photo finish if we ever saw one. The winner? Well, let us say with utmost respect, good old Mexican dignity and politeness. We could stand a little more of it in the USA. The day of the conferencia between Mr. Adamski and the eminent doctors arrived. We picked Mr. Adamski up in our car in front of his quaint little Mexican hotel and started for the residence where the affair was to be held. We had a terrible time finding the place and became quite concerned about being late, as we understood this to be a North American appointment. In case our readers are a bit puzzled, we learned that there are two kinds of appointments across the border, the North American and the Mexican varieties. The former means you keep the appointment on time. The latter means you do as you please and no apologies are required if you show up a couple of hours late, or not at all. It's the mores. Finally, we found the address and caught a glimpse of a very dignified and distinguished figure in a frock coat waiting for us out in front on the sidewalk. We were late. Trying to think quickly of a few appropriate Spanish words of apology, I jumped out of the car ahead of the others and rushed over to this grand Mexican personage. I was just about to open my mouth and apologize for our lateness when, what do you think happened? Yes, it could only have happened in dear old Mexico. The dear fellow put his arms around me, and in a voice expressing deep emotion said in Spanish, "Señor Adamski. My son. This is your home." Oh, no, this just couldn't happen. But in the confusion I was quite sure it was my back and nobody else's that was being affectionately patted. I felt lower than a Mexican peso. I was stunned, embarrassed no end, my mind was not working. I did not know what to do. Then, as if in a distance, I heard a voice. It must have been mine, because no other voice could sound quite as embarrassed or speak quite such poor Spanish. It said, "No, No, senor doctor, me no Adamski, me no Adamski. Just then the real Adamski came in sight with Helen in hot pursuit. I heard my voice continue, Estes senor Adamski. The Mexicans are great people. Without losing rhythm and with the dignity of a monarch, the good doctor turned graciously around, calmly transferred the embrace to the right recipient and one again heard the words, Senor Adamski. My son. This is your home. It sounded more fervent than the first time. After all, practice makes perfect. What a people. Inside the house was a beautiful patio and a small chapel. In the latter were gathered a group of 20 or 30 members of the medical profession. A gracious hostess presided over the proceedings, and George Adamski was asked to speak. We had all learned by this time that such occasions are very informal in Mexico as to audience participation. A speaker can be, and usually is, interrupted by questions and even orations from the audience. It is much different than in the States. This meeting was no exception. Mr. Adamski recounted some of his experiences in English. No one was designated as interpreter, as many of those present could understand and speak both Spanish and English. Thus every one acted as interpreter, and English and Spanish soon became so intermingled that we got all mixed up and were not quite sure what was going on. In fact, we were not quite sure whether Senor Adamski was telling them or they were telling him. Helen looked a bit worried and whispered to me, are they for him, or agin him? I can't make out. I whispered that wonderful Mexican phrase which settles so many things that cannot otherwise be settled, quien sabe. Then one doctor arose and left us in no doubt, even though his expressions were 90% in Spanish. He evidently was terribly annoyed with both Mr. Adamski's experiences and his conclusions. He wound up with the forceful statement in plain English, and so, sir, you have not convinced me at all. All eyes turned toward Mr. Adamski seated behind the little table. He arose unperturbed and calmly replied, my friend, I am not here to convince you or anyone. Even Christ with his message did not convince everyone. I merely came at your request to tell you of my experiences. Touche, for Senor Adamski. After the meeting adjourned, we went upstairs where delicious refreshments were served by our gracious hostess. Over their coffee cups they all discussed Mr. Adamski's experiences at great length, and we all enjoyed the occasion very much. At Insurgents Theatre. Act 2 of our bizarre drama occurred at Insurgents Theatre, which had been rented by the English-speaking group for a public lecture by Mr. Adamski. We called for him in our car to drive by the theater in the daytime, and sure enough over the marquee in large letters appeared the sign, Conferencia Los Platillos Voladores por George Adamski. The entire front wall of this imposing building is composed of an incredible mural made of tiny squares, of colored mosaic tiles and was designed by Diego Rivera, the noted Mexican artist. Mr. Adamski admired it very much. Later, despite the setback of the press conference by which the lecture received practically no newspaper publicity, the group went courageously ahead, distributed placards and personally notified all their friends who were interested. He charged to help defray expenses was the sum of 5 pesos, 40 cents US. Even without proper advertising, a goodly number of people swarmed into the theater. Bilge made the introduction, and Mr. Adamski proceeded to wear out 2 interpreters telling about sources. When the lecture was only partially finished, a television program tried desperately to televise part of the performance, but the committee decided it would cause too much confusion and would be unfair to the theater audience. After the lecture, in the lobby we saw Senor and Señor Diego Rivera, and Mr. Adamski seemed very pleased to meet the great artist responsible for the beautiful mosaic mural on the front of the theater. All the time behind the scenes the villain stalked unseen and unknown. He made note of the fact that right in this lecture Mr. Adamski had committed a fearful crime or the committee would never have guessed what it was, no, not in a million years. Maybe the reader can guess. The plot thickens at the reception. Act 3. Then came the grand reception at the American Club, arranged by the English-speaking committee, All in the interest of sources. Lights, photographers, caviar, cocktails, reception lines, introductions, music. Distinguished men in fine attire and beautiful ladies in colorful dress. A sprinkling of diplomats and military personnel. And waiters really doing their stuff.